This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
Welcome to What's News Dunedin, brought to you by Casa Valencia, the radio show that spawned from the 23,000 plus strong Lokaloti Poiti Dunedin What's News Dunedin Facebook group. The group that's been putting the social back in the social media since 2020, with respectful adult debate and a sense of humour. I'm your host, Richard Knights. On today's show, we talk to our wonderful guest, Brandon Johnson, local Dunedin activist, who were telling us a bit more about themselves and what they do, as well as helping us look back at the posts that generate the most interactions over the past 7 days on the What's News Dunedin Facebook group. Now, those posts this week are Councillor Ong breaching a confidentiality, landing him with yet another code of conduct complaint against him. A wheelchair user who was hit on a pedestrian crossing by a car, having to raise $9,000 to replace their written-off wheelchair. And immigration refusing visas to a Lebanese parents of a couple that have just had a new baby because they didn't believe that they would return to Lebanon after their visit. Welcome to the show, Brandon.
Thank you very much for having me.
Awesome. Before we get into the serious stuff of the news, etc., we will do we have a pun of the week on the show, right? So what happens is we have Pun Day Monday on the group. Everyone brings their best dad jokes and puns, and then basically if it's whoever gets the most laugh reacts gets the joke brought on the show on a Friday. So we see if it comes off the page, see what it's funny. There's no obligation to laugh here, but we'll see if it makes the cut, basically. So our pun of the week this week was a friend of mine said he has no idea how cloning works. I said that makes two of us.
I'm glad you said there's no obligation to laugh. It's one of those quiet thinkers.
Because it is a little bit like, oh, yeah, cloning, two of us. Oh, yeah, I get it. Yeah, absolutely, yeah. So, but that's okay. We're allowed that pause for think. Do I find that funny or not? I like wordplay, so these kind of things they always make me smile. Now we also have our three pop questions. So three pop questions, basically to get under the skin of you as a human being. No right or wrong answers unless you get it wrong. But the first question is cream teas. Now cream teas, where you have a scone, you have jam, you have cream. The big question for you is, what goes on the scone first, the jam or the cream?
Right, the jam goes first, right? I mean. Surely.
I'm a firm believer in jam first. Yeah, exactly. Excellent. There are some strange
people. There's a safe space then.
Exactly. Yeah. There's been some strange people on the show that actually have said the other way around. And we haven't fallen out over it, but at the same time, I do question their
own. They just want to make a mess, you know.
That's it. How do you put you –
They
you
just don't want to colour in the lines, you know.
No, exactly.
Maybe I'm too boring in that I want a scone that's edible, but, you know, what do I know?
What exactly? And I liked about pile up the cream not real high.
Exactly.
If when I put it in my mouth, it doesn't hit me in the nose.
The mess goes on your face, not on the table where you're prepping it, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that to me – I had the strangest of occurrences. It's a very big thing in England, like back at Devon and Cornwall. Two counties are in the southwest of England that are very right next to each other, but they do it the different way. The Cornish do jam and cream, and then Devon do cream, then jam, which is really weird, right? Mm. But then I had
Is that why there's a border?
I think that's why there's a border, and it's patrolled as well. It's the only border in the UK that's actually patrolled because of this, the risk that you might get, you know, cross
over. Got to save lives, yeah,
exactly.
Fair enough.
But then I had a person from Cornwall who did it the Devon way. On the show, and that just blew my mind.
Must have been a real social pariah.
I'm not sure.
Maybe an undercover, some sort of
secret agent. Secret. But the thing is, I'm not sure they'll ever be that. After obviously sort of vocalising this on this show, which is obviously global because it's on all the platforms. I'm not sure she'll ever be able to go back. That's the risk.
She'll
have to meet her relatives in Devon now.
Got to find a safe sort of third space.
Absolutely. Yeah. There needs like a Switzerland somewhere, somewhere in the border.
Some sort of British Switzerland.
That doesn't make any sense whatsoever. But anyway, second question, and that's the only question you can get wrong on my show, and you pass with flying colours, so that's a great start. Excellent. Second question is, who is your favourite Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle?
Whoa, that's taken me a ways back. You know, it was my sort of primary school after TV show. I think is Michelangelo the sort of the loose unit.
They're all cool.
They're all cool. They all love pizza. You know,
yeah, exactly.
They all love hanging out with a rat in the sewer. I mean,
exactly. There's no downsides on the old Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. But they're all Renaissance painters, right? Raphael, Leonardo, Michelangelo, and Donatello. So, Mikey is a great choice.
I think kid me loved Mikey. I think I'd have to go back and watch now and see see how I felt about them. But yeah. That's little 6-year-old Brandon is all in for Mikey.
That's totally fine. Now, third and final question, and this is a bit of a thinker rather than like, you know, feel to jump right in. If you've got the answer, you just go for it, right? Would you rather have the most comfortable mattress in the world or have all your clothes fit perfectly?
I'm going to go with comfortable mattress.
Yep.
I think if my clothes are kind of annoying, I can live with it. But if I don't have the beautiful beauty sleep that I need, I'm a much less nice person than I am now.
Right.
So I think this is kind of maybe a social utility thing.
Yeah.
If I don't have a comfy mattress,
yeah,
it's just bad for everyone else.
Watch out, yeah. Ultimately.
And I'm going to take that mattress.
I think I'd go the same because like I spend a lot of time trying to sleep. Uh-huh. So like, the more comfortable mattress that I've got, I think the better for everyone. Like because like a grumpy rich is not. You know, it's not someone that anyone wants to be hanging around, to be fair. Even a happy rich, a lot of people don't want to hang around with me. But
I'm here, aren't I?
Well, exactly, mate. Like, but you might halfway through the show, you'd be like, I've had enough.
It's all the 20s you're tossing me under the table, right?
Yeah. Exactly. Shh. Other guests will expect the same. They'll all come back to me for more money. I think I'm with you there on the comfortable mattress. I mean, there's nothing like a good night's sleep, like genuinely. Like I think when we've all had that sometimes we wake up in the morning and go, I've had the best sleep. You just have a fantastic day afterwards.
Exactly.
Because that's what it's all about. Uh-huh. Cool. So those are the three pop questions. But let's go back and talk about the news. Now, I have to say genuinely, I've said this for the last 6 weeks in a row, I'm genuinely bored of talking about this, but Councillor Wrong. It seems every day another thing, another story, another splash in the media. But the big one this week, and I knew it was coming because like the news got broken the week before that he'd sent an email, or copied media into an email which he shouldn't have copied them into. And basically, when the email chain had gone beyond him, and they'd kind of again excluded the media, he then copied the media back into the subsequent exchanges to actually kind of loop them back in when everyone else had kind of gone, hang on, this is confidential stuff. We need to exclude the media, and he's copied them back in again. So so I knew that it was going to be a code of conduct complaint coming because how could there not be? I mean, it is such a blatant. There's no gray areas here. It's such a blatant breach of his responsibilities as a councillor that it had to happen. And it did. And the first thing that he did when he was sent a confidential email.
Can I guess?
Go on.
Did he put it on Facebook?
He sent it to the media again.
Okay.
So he's
it was on Facebook at some point.
Absolutely. But what happened was he gets sent the confidential email from the CEO, Sandy Graham, who basically says the information in this email, because it's now part of a code of conduct complaint, is confidential. So any sharing of this information would therefore be a further breach of the code of conduct. And within 6 minutes, he'd copied in ODT, Stuff, NZMe, and six other media outlets, or six media outlets in total. Mm-hmm. I'm just really struggling with it, right? Because a lot of councillors have sort of platformed transparency, right? And I'm all for transparency, right? Because I'm all for people knowing what their council is doing, knowing what the councillors are doing, knowing what the staff are doing. But there is always some elements of confidentiality that have to be maintained because of A, data privacy laws, full stop, employment privacy, commercial sensitivity. There are lots of reasons for things to be confidential, sometimes permanently, other times temporarily. And this notification about the hotel, whatever, that someone, a company looking into the viability of a hotel at the stadium or near the stadium, was one of those things that would be temporarily confidential.
Yeah.
While it was still commercially sensitive, right? And the right reasons for this, if someone knows that you want to buy a piece of land and you go, I'd like to buy that piece of land, please, and they go, well, that's $3, please. But they know that you so desperately need it, they go, $27, please. Mm-hmm. You know, that costs the ratepayer money, right? That's cost the ratepayer another $24. I can do the math. I'm pretty quick, like straight in my head, mate. There you go. And on a Friday. Mm-hmm. you know, that's cost the ratepayer substantially more money, right? So there's a reason for keeping that information quiet until the $3 has changed hands and they go, oh, and afterwards they go, oh, didn't know. If I'd have known it was for that, I would have charged them more, you know? Mm-hmm. Because that's business. That's capitalism, right?
Sure.
So then Councillor Long's kind of going, I'm just being transparent. And you're going, well, you're not being transparent. You're actually being willfully sort of almost belligerent in the sense of sharing that information, because actually there is a you have a responsibility. And it would have been explained to you in your induction if you'd have gone to it. And I believe he hasn't spent a lot of time getting inducted. I believe there was times when he should have been there and he wasn't. But there's a reason for it. What are your thoughts on it?
Yeah, I mean, much like you probably, I mean, you have to pay attention to this because apparently you're talking about it every week.
yeah, exactly. I get no choice.
I've checked out a little bit of the Benedict Ong drama in the last month just because it feels so much of the same, which seems to be because he doesn't seem to take seriously the role of governance, you know, what that actually means in being an elected official. And like you say, I mean, conflating the ideas of transparency or not counterposing them with the needs for personal privacy. You know, I work in payroll. I see a lot of information. If I saw, I don't know, somebody's ACC reimbursement case and I said, you know, oh, for the sake of transparency, I just want to make sure that everyone knows that my colleague, you know, broke their leg climbing a wall one day. Obviously, you know, I'm in breach of privacy laws and I shouldn't be sharing that information. I think that's the same principle.
Yeah, and it's but the funny thing, the thing that really like twists my brain a little bit and actually makes it itch from the inside out is when he blatantly breaches the code of conduct, right? Blatantly. Like there's no one on the planet that could look at that and go, you didn't breach the code of conduct. Mm-hmm. But then when the actual code of conduct complaint arrives, he's accusing everyone of political attack and, well, it's as clear as day that the person that caused the problem is yourself. Mm-hmm. And this is the absolutely written down, if you read the legislation, this is the outcome that you could have expected from doing the thing that you've chosen to do. Mm-hmm. It's not the mayor now trying to silence you or the CEO trying to attack you. It's them doing exactly what you've driven them to do, mm-hmm. because that's the way it's all written down.
And this is what I mean about not understanding the role, not only of just governance as, you know, as opposed to being a staff member, but just also not having any sort of political nous in how to operate in these spaces. I mean, if you are wanting to be a councillor because you want to, you know, represent your constituents, which, you know, according to Benedict Ong, you know, this is the most special city with the most special citizens.
Yeah.
If those are people that you want to represent, then you also need to know how to be functional in that spaces. You need to know how to take the will of your constituents, present them to, you know, your colleagues in the council in a way that they see, you know, that they can hear your arguments, they can understand you. If you alienate every single person on council for the sake of, you know, I know he's masquerading it as principle, but it's just put everyone offside to the point where, like me, I can be a bit of a political hobbyist. If I want something to be presented in council, you know that I'm not going to go to Benedict Ong, because immediately if he brings something up, there's going to be this sort of negative perception in the room around him. Why is he bringing up? What's his motivation? I don't understand why he's saying this. And also, this person has, you know, shared my private information or, you know, allegations and these other processes online. This person's kind of politically poisonous to this agenda, so I don't want to support. I don't know. I don't understand.
No, neither do I. And week after week, I would have thought that I would have actually got a better understanding because I'm talking about it constantly. But I've actually got a lesser. I genuinely believe I've got a lesser understanding. Being on council, you need another 7 people to progress your, you know, anything that you want to do, right? Mm-hmm. And if you've upset all your peers, and it would appear that he has, because he's now saying he doesn't feel welcome in the councillor space. Well, again, that's on you, mate. Like, mm-hmm. genuinely, you've put yourself in that position. It's like going in and to the breakfast buffet and then sneezing in every single person, every single dish, all the way along the line at the breakfast buffet, and then wondering why no one wants to eat the food and no one wants to sit with you when you're sat there with a plate of sneezed on scrambled eggs, you know?
Yeah. And the thing is, like, I, you know, on principle, I support the right of any councillor to, you know, stand by their principles. They were elected, they were put there. But I don't think that this is a path to any sort of effective politics, you know? And, and that means that I support the right for somebody to be deeply unpopular, even, you know, disliked by the entirety of council. Again, on principle, if you're elected to represent your constituents, there's a reason the threshold for getting somebody out of council is so high, right?
Yeah.
But then I feel like maybe we also have a problem in that we have no right of recall. It's like the central government as well, right? If somebody comes in on promises and then decides to toss those promises aside, they can do whatever they want for 3 years. For example, they might, you know, destroy pay equity under urgency, despite the fact that that wasn't discussed in the public, you know? But the public then has no option by which we can say, okay, we're going to go out and sort of organize maybe, you know, a petition. There's no threshold to trigger a re-election by the population, like the citizenship. It's only those sort of central powers that can do that. So Benedict Ong either resigns or stays there.
Yeah, although the one thing in central government is you can get sacked.
Mm-hmm.
You can which is different to local government, mm-hmm. which is strange. Obviously, you're right about that elected period. Mm-hmm. You know, you could have, we've got this party, you know, this coalition at the moment, and there's nothing we can do about it unless they called a snap election for themselves. But Luxon can get ousted. I mean, as the leader of the coalition, Winston Peters could again get pushed out as a leader. Like, they can sack their MPs that are seen to do things that aren't right, and you quite often see that where you know allegations come to light of things that are poor behaviour. Like the guy, I can't remember his name, but got drunk at one of these functions and called and told someone to get F off or something. But you know, he got I can't remember his name. But he got sacked. In local government, you don't even have that option.
That's true. You just will be extremely unpopular if you're extremely unpopular.
And that's it.
And then you wait till the next election.
Yeah, it's crazy. Anyway, I'm sure I will be talking about this again next week because it's already kicking off with their stuff, you know, for the news for next week's news cycle. Anyway, but and he's just turned around yesterday and said he wants to be here for decades.
Don't at me on Facebook, Benedict Ong.
Yeah, totally. Perfect.
I think he ran a really – I did not enjoy his campaign, but I cannot knock the hustle of somebody who spends basically full time going out and talking to people and gets into council on that basis. It's just a shame that he doesn't seem willing to, you know, take good faith advice.
No.
I think that's my last note that's on Benedict Ong.
I think the 44 grand he spent as well probably helped.
Yeah, true. I think money does have a pretty big impact in elections, hot take. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. Who would have guessed, eh?
Bigger conversation, maybe.
Next topic of the week is the wheelchair user that was hit on a pedestrian crossing. I think it was in McAndrew Road, South Dunedin. Was literally flown in the air by the car. It got three quarters of the way across a pedestrian crossing, got hit. There's been a number of accidents in that area, I believe, on those pedestrian crossings over the last little while. If it's the same one I'm thinking about on McAndrew Road. And then having to raise $9,000 to replace their own damaged wheelchair. And I was gobsmacked by this. And not for probably the reasons people think about it. Like, thankfully, they weren't seriously hurt. But they do have a genetic condition where injuries that they have sustained will take a lot longer to heal and recuperate. So there's a journey ahead of them here. But I can't believe two things. One, they're having to pay for their own wheelchair. Secondly, that the wheelchair itself is $9,000, and I'm not trying to suggest that they should be $900 or anything like that, or that, and there was some talk on the page about Temu. Well, just go to Temu and get this is something you spend a lot of time in, right? You need to have a wheelchair that's fitted to you, et cetera, et cetera. But if you consider that the secondhand car that most people drive probably costs similar or less, which has airbags and safety features and all these manner of other bits and pieces, it seems like it's just an opportunity to screw over our most vulnerable with something that you go, hey, well, you need it. That's supply and demand thing. You need it, therefore I'm going to charge you as much as I damn well like. And then the second bit that I was appalled by is that, A, it's not funded because they don't class their disability as a funding disability, but they need a wheelchair. And secondly, like they were talking about ACT wouldn't pick up it, or the insurance for the car wouldn't pick it. There's so many things that just literally like sort of like blew my thinking and that, and I'm kind of going, but again, screwed over for a start. Like, it just does not seem fair that I can go and buy a car for 10 grand with all these safety features. All right, they need a wheelchair. They can't get funded for a wheelchair. Thankfully, they give a little pay, just generate the income that they need, which is awesome. Great community stuff, and that's brilliant. But it just seems like, you know, you take our most vulnerable, and then you literally punch down on them again and again and again and again until they almost want to just stay inside and live a completely non-existent. And that's just not right in my mind.
Yeah.
Thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, this may or may not surprise you, but I think that is a pretty clear-cut result of free market neoliberalism, which, again, may or may not surprise you, but I think that's trash. I actually found out a couple of days ago that I don't know this person personally, but the person who got hit, you know, our values have kind of led us to operate in similar spaces. So I've seen this person around. Very friendly, very social by the looks of it, has good support networks, which I think probably goes some way to explain the very thankfully successful crowdfunding project. But the fact that, you know, a person's health, mobility, accessibility relies on having to ask other people for them to pitch in, you know, we're relying on this personal charity rather than systems to actually help protect people and make sure that people can like fully participate in society. And I think that's pretty heartbreaking, you know. I mean, lots has been said about chronic underfunding of the health system, and this is a part of it. I mean, as a society, broadly speaking, surely the purpose of us existing is to make things better for people rather than to make sure that whoever owns things makes a lovely profit while people who get hit by cars in their wheelchair have to go, you know, hat in hand for money. I don't know. The whole thing's really broken my heart, except for, you know, that successful crowdfunding. Yeah, and I think the other thing, what you're mentioning about the series of accidents that's happened, I mean, I think if a problem exists and it keeps happening over and over, then the problem is not, you know, these people just need to think better or to do better let's call out another councillor candidate. I was at you were there. I was at OUSA recently for the council candidate panel, and we're talking about the safety project that's going on Albany Street and the redesign. And former councillor Andrew Wiley kept referring to the need to just for people to exercise their personal responsibility rather than to like make a system level change. If he was making the argument that there are like greater priorities, that's one thing. But to suggest that the solution to any problem is personal responsibility, as a politician, what you're saying is, I don't think that problem can be solved, or I don't want to solve it, or if only we had a magical wand and people were different. I don't know. I think from a systems thinking level, you need to see why that problem keeps happening and figure out how to fix it. Surely that's the role of our elected representatives, is to solve problems that are hurting people and that are making access more difficult. I don't know. So it really frustrated me to hear the arguments of personal responsibility floated out again, which I think, again, is just kind of it's like the social result of economic neoliberalism, which is a bunch of kind of insufferable words to say, when you make everything user pays and individualized, then over time people start to think in that way as well. Well, you had a mistake, therefore it's your problem to solve, rather than there's something wrong in our communities. Well, how do we collectively fix that?
Fair enough. Third and final topic is the, I don't know if you saw this, was the immigration, New Zealand refusing to issue visas to a couple's Lebanese parents that were trying to come over here to help look after the baby that they just had, a process and an immigration process, that visa process that they'd started before the current conflict in Lebanon had scaled up to what it is right now. And despite trying to give evidence to suggest, or even pay a bond to sort of like say, they're not staying here. They've got family. They've still got a daughter back in Lebanon that they need to go back home to. They're only here to temporarily assist while we, you know, while we get past that whole, you know, first baby, brand new baby phase. Mm-hmm. And affidavit, God knows, all the evidence they provided, they were refused a visa to come here because immigration didn't believe they'd return home. Because there's now a conflict in Lebanon that many people would try to get away from. Now, I totally get that, but they, in my mind, they didn't start the process when the conflict was, you know, there wasn't a conflict going on when they started the process. They've got reason to go home, right? And we can expel people. If we know who they are, we can expel people if they overstay their visas anyway, regardless, right? It just seems a real cruel sort of section of events to get to that. To get to where they are. I had a baby when we first got here in New Zealand 15 years ago. We had our third child, and my mum came over from the UK and stayed for 4 months or whatever it was to help us with the baby. She stayed for a long time, you know, and there was never any question of whether she would not return. You know, she had a return ticket. There was never consideration that her visa would not be renewed. Obviously, there wasn't conflict happening in the UK, but she could have just as easily not gone home.
Yeah, yeah. I haven't been following this particular story. I must have missed this one. That's definitely something I would have read about if I saw it come up. I mean, that's really heartbreaking. Look, I mean, even if these people were secretly looking for refugee status, like that's the fear, right? They're going to get over there and they're going to become asylum seekers and they're going to look for refugee and then, you know, God forbid, might become like working members of our community. I don't think that's a reason to gate people out, you know? That's a slightly different argument than what you're making, obviously. The other part of that is that, I mean, we have refugee quotas. I don't think they're high enough. I don't think New Zealand is you know, doing its part in the international community to make sure that we provide homes for people who are, you know, subjected to invasion and sometimes ethnic cleansing of their home. You know, I mean, I'm sure you've been following the south of Lebanon is being, you know, militarily cleansed by the Israeli Defense Force right now. And I think rather than, you know, the sort of fear-mongering that's going around about people from other places in the world are coming to our community, what does that mean for our culture, you know? I think we ought to look to root causes of these invasions, of these wars. I mean, New Zealand is, you know, has these R&D relationships and economic relationships with Israel, which is, you know, committing a genocide. We launch satellites from Rocket Lab to make sure that those bombs land where the IDF wants them to. Whether we like it or not, you know, the political class of our country has had a role to play in displacing these people and creating those fears that people will become refugees. So I think for us as sort of ordinary people in the country, we should stand in solidarity with those people. We should invite them. We should stick up for them when, you know, let's be honest, when they become racialized or, you know, we see the way that, for example, historically Chinese people and today Indian people are sort of put forth as these, you know, these stereotypes because they're poorer workers, right? Because they're working class, as opposed to the other side of the coin. So going on my crank take again here, but that's fine. So migrant labor is highly policed by the state. But on the other hand, migrant capital, that is to say, you know, rich folks are allowed in on these golden visas. We have Peter Thiel, one of, I would argue, one of the most evil people on the earth right now. He's got a friggin' mansion in Queenstown. I think that we should support ordinary people more than we should support these hyper wealthy, you know, surveillance tech bros. I may have gone slightly off the topic.
That's
there,
all right. But that's okay.
That's what I do.
We're going to come back to the topics that you want to talk about in a second. But before we do, we're going to get a very quick word from our wonderful sponsor.
Dunedin, meet your new favourite bakery. Casa Valencia at 53 Musselburgh Rise is serving up freshly baked bread, pastries and gorgeous cakes. And if you haven't tried the ube donut yet, you are seriously missing out. Our signature purple yam donut and purple yam drink are the must-try combos your taste buds have been waiting for. Pair it all with a hot or cold drink, grab a cake for someone special and make your day a little sweeter. Casa Valencia, 53 Musselburgh Rise, Dunedin. Open Monday to Saturday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. See you there.
Are you aware of Casa Valencia?
Yes, I went there. I actually used to live down the road briefly with, I believe, your executive producer, Callie Campbell. and my house flooded, and Callie very nicely put me up in her house for a couple of months. And me and my partner, Valeria, went down the road and had an incredible meal at Cafe Valencia. So, big fan.
They've got some fantastic food, wonderful human beings. Mm-hmm. I may or may not have been there just before the show, bought some donuts for my wife because it's her birthday. Mm-hmm. Happy birthday, Cindy. But they are, because my office is right there as well on that little stretch. So every day I'm in
they're
there.
So nice,
and they're just
yeah.
beautiful people. So I encourage anyone who's listening to go out there and have a taste of some fantastic food. I want to talk about you, Brandon Johnston. Obviously, I introduced you as a local Dunedin activist, and that might mean lots of different things to lots of different people, depending on, you know, where you come into, you know, standing up for causes, etc. I would consider myself not to be an activist, but apparently I am, mm-hmm. you know, because I'm vocal about the things that I care about, and I'm willing to go out there and stand up for it, which I think it's a fantastic thing. I think we should do more of that. But perhaps you can give us a little bit of 5-minute kind of Cliff Notes version of Brandon, how you get to be here, like what brings you and your passion for cause to, you know, to bring you here to talk to me today?
Yeah, four big questions. I want to start on that activist label, because what you said there is also very true to me. Like, I didn't think of myself as an activist, but apparently I am. It's like, I've had a funny relationship with that label, and I've come to realize it's just because I think that everyone should be an activist and that we shouldn't sort of have this kind of activist, non-activist
Agreed.
Dichotomy. You know, when if my colleagues, one of the things that I'm an activist for is my union, the Tertiary Education Union at the university. Some of my colleagues will go around and put up posters, and then they'll, you know, come to meetings and talk about, you know, workload issues and things like that. Like, that you're kind of being an activist for yourself and for your colleagues if you do that. There's this, I think, kind of stereotypical image of an activist, you know, going out there with a flag and the megaphone and, you know, doing whatever on the street, which I also do, to be fair.
Yep.
But, you know, I think it's, like I said, there's this sort of dichotomy between being one and not being one. You know, I'm just an ordinary person, not an activist. Like, if you care about something, if your values drive you to care about something, then you can get involved with it. And sometimes people ask me how to do that. And I think the answer is if you care about something, you're not the only one. Look for other people who are doing it and, you know, have a chat with them. And then before you know it, suddenly you'll be very tired because you've lost the plot and you're going to every meeting, and then you have to peel yourself back, and then you'll say, okay, I guess I'm an activist if I'm going to these nerdy, you know, organizing meetings in the evening.
And you spend a lot of time in those activist nerdy type meetings?
Way too much. what people see, you know, for example, I've been active in the Palestine Solidarity Movement for many years now, and, you know, people see you when you're out on the street, like I say, with flags. People don't necessarily see you, you know, in an organizing meeting discussing, you know, how to raise awareness, how to talk to people. Should we go out with a petition? Who's handling the mailing list? Who is going in their high-vis gear and making sure that everyone is safe when we do march through the streets? All of those sorts of things. And, you know, union is different again. You know, we meet up and we talk strategy, we talk, you know, industrial issues, what does our employment contract look like, what do we want in the next round of bargaining. All of those things are much less sexy than the loud stuff that is sort of in people's minds under the activist label, but it's all mahi that needs to be done, and it's kind of a thankless work that, I still find it really rewarding, you know, but if you do those things collectively, then I think you can, you know, create these networks of people who care about each other and have the same values as you do, and that's really powerful.
So what was the trigger for you? What kind of made you – was there a moment you kind of went, oh, There was a moment where you kind of went, I need to be involved, right? Like, because for me, I probably would have sleepwalked through my first 30 something years on the planet I wouldn't say I was selfish. I always cared about bits and pieces, but it never really crossed my mind to take that care, and you know, and anyone that knows me knows I've got a big mouth and I'll always talk about stuff, but take that care and turn it into something bigger, more collective, more visible. All right, yeah. Probably in the last 5-10 years, that's changed for me, and I don't know what changed for me. I don't know if becoming a father made me care more. It certainly made me cry more. I've cried more as a dad than I ever did in the years before. Because emotionally, I'm just a mess now. Mm-hmm. I'm the guy that the tissue advert comes on and I'm in floods. And my wife's looking at me, what are you crying about? It's so sad. That's me, right? But I want to leave something behind for my Tamariki, for my Mokopuna, right? That's what I want. That's kind of bubbled up in me over the last little while.
Yeah.
And kind of push me to where I'm making a stand for all the things that I see value in. What was it for you?
I mean, that's really beautiful. First of all, just to just to genuinely hear what brought you to thinking about social issues and how they will affect the next generation, through your family. We all come to our activist, quote unquote, mahi in different ways. For me, I think it was a lot of, there were a few small steps. I was very much the same in that I watched things, I cared, I thought about myself as a person with a moral compass that I thought was respectable. But I didn't really turn that into anything actionable for a big part of my life. And that kind of became a conflict within myself. It's sort of like, what's different between me and somebody with much worse ideas who also doesn't do anything? I think one of the earlier political awakenings that I had was in high school watching, I think it's called Patu. It's a documentary about the Springbok tour in New Zealand and the organizing against it. And some of the scenes in that film are really upsetting. Protesters being beaten by cops with batons and that sort of thing. And, there's an image where you see somebody just like walking towards the camera dazed with, blood and everything on their face. And that always stuck with me. But I thought if anything like that happened again in my lifetime, if there was, a deeply racist political system and there was a way for us, whatever you want to call us, members of the international community, to do something about that, then I would like to be one of those people who did something, especially in a context where you have a government that, doesn't care or that aligns with that racist regime. So that was really something that I think I mulled around over in my brain for a few years. And then when I eventually went to university, I started off in Canterbury and then eventually I came to Otago University, and I just met a lot of different people from a lot of different walks of life. And, I had grown up in this sort of, middle class, upper middle class, maybe, well enough off, I'm trying to think of the right phrase. I never had to fear for my safety or that my puku would be full of food. I had those levels of comfort, and then I would meet all of these people who didn't have that, and that kind of, again, expand my understanding of, it sounds silly to say, but just what people are and where people come from, and that people aren't, raised with this image of these poor people in poor communities who are some sort of caricature, and that's just not how human beings work. And then I think working full time in the private sector was my sort of big last step of my political awakening, which was just that I was working in a job where I was paid less than a living wage. Sometimes I had to come in and work on a Saturday for no extra money, and then we would go to meetings and we would talk about how the profit numbers aren't high enough and what we have to do to boot them up. And then I would go back to my computer and do our marketing business. And I just felt so unfulfilled and like my day-to-day life was a bit pointless. Like, what am I doing? I'm spending my life wasting away making sure that I make money for this company. So I ended up leaving that job and taking some gig work at the university, some temp work. And that's kind of when I learned about collective agreements and how they protect workers and how they make sure that you are not, you know, hyper exploited by bosses who want you to come in on the weekend and do all this extra work for free. At the same time, I was sort of looking for political ideas outside of my usual. Some of my friends who were also doing this union work were attending meetings at the International Socialist Organization branch. I started going to that, and I kind of threw myself into union work and well, eventually I threw myself into the socialist organizing as well, the political education as well as the organizing side of that. And that was sort of the trajectory that took me to where I am now. So I'm an activist, I suppose, and it all just kind of stems from values, frustrations of the world. There is a moralism to it. I don't feel like I lean heavily on the moralism side, but I, you know, there are injustices in the world, and if I can do a little bit collectively with other people to address that, then I will do my best to do so.
I love the term moral compass. It's a term that I use a lot to describe myself, because I firmly believe that I have a strong moral compass. I believe that my sense of doing always points in the right direction. You know, you wouldn't catch me doing something illegal or immoral or, you know, that kind of thing. I'm not wired that way, right? And it's just one of those things. But what the one word that I wanted to pick up on you is socialism.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think it's one of the most misunderstood words in New Zealand, because it's something that I've come from the UK. It's not a word that was bandied around very often, right? Mm-hmm. But it does get bandied around here a lot more than what I've seen in my past, but in the completely wrong context. So it's a word that's been used, you know, to equal Marxism or communism or, you know, things that we are almost hardwired as a Western, as someone that's come from a Western democracy, to sort of rally against, you know. But socialism isn't that, is it?
It depends on who you ask, is the short answer.
Go on.
I am a Marxist, so we're gonna come from that perspective. The reason that the word socialism is so confusing to people is because in New Zealand, I mean, there's definitely a tradition of socialist thought in New Zealand, but, you know, we've never had a socialist force that challenged, you know, the capitalist production or anything like that, you know. Even in the UK, there are, you know, socialist organizations that number in the thousands. We don't have that in New Zealand. So for a lot of people, the word socialism has kind of been conflated with, you know, like in the 70s, for example, the government would use these crazy Russian communists as a kind of scare tactic. That's something that happened during the Spring Walk Tour, right, is that all of these activists were labeled as like secret Russian agents or something, secret Bolsheviks. And, you know, there may have been some Bolsheviks, some, you know, some ideological Marxists in those organizations. There probably were. The vast majority of those people came from, you know, trade unions and churches and other things and wanted to build a social movement. So it's, I think we have a real legacy of sort of Red Scare in this country that stops us being able to talk about these ideas specifically. So, you know, Marxism is a theoretical framework that analyzes basically the history of classes, the way that classes are tied with certain systems of production. For us, we live in a world of commodity production. We live in a world where we live in New Zealand. New Zealand has been, you know, it was a settler colonial country. It's sort of coalesced into, you know, market capitalism today. That's been around for less than 200 years. Every single person listening to this has been around for less time than that. So we exist in the conditions that we understand. Capitalism as a world system has only been around, well, as a system broadly, has only been around for about 300 years. But it's hard for us to sort of look at that with a broader scope because our minds are wired to the way we exist. So for me, socialism is equivalent to, you know, workers' control, workers' rights, the ability for us to, you know, bring democracy into our workplaces in the same way that we have, you know, a level of democracy over a political system. You know, I was referring to that old job before. I had no voice there. I had no, you know, control over what I was creating. It was because I don't own anything. All I own is my time and my ability to do labor for that company. So I would say, please pay me a wage, pay me a salary. And then they would say, cool, here's your employment agreement, here's your job description, do what we tell you, come to our meetings and talk about how to make our shareholders more money. For me, philosophically, that's a complete dead end to me feeling like I can flourish as a human being. The closer, the more impact that I have over the work I'm doing, the more, I guess in Marxist terms, unalienated I feel, the more I feel like I have control and the more I feel like I am creating something socially collective with other people.
Fantastic. I want to pick up on a couple of things in a second, but before we do, I'm just going to get another word from our fantastic sponsor.
Dunedin, meet your new favourite bakery. Casa Valencia at 53 Musselburgh Rise is serving up freshly baked bread, pastries and gorgeous cakes. And if you haven't tried the ube donut yet, you are seriously missing out. Our signature purple yam donut and purple yam drink are the must-try combos your taste buds have been waiting for. Pair it all with a hot or cold drink, grab a cake for someone special and make your day a little sweeter. Casa Valencia, 53 Musselburgh Rise, Dunedin. Open Monday to Saturday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. See you there.
One of the things I struggle with, and I think it's because I care, is where do I stop? All right. So, like, you know, I care about inclusion. I care about our Rainbow Funnel. I care about our Trans Funnel. I care about our disabled. I care about accessibility. I care about our healthcare or our hospital. I care about our Palestinian Funnel. At some point, I kind of keep thinking, like, my list gets longer and longer and longer. Mm-hmm. Do you find the same thing? And obviously there'll be issues and causes that you kind of fundamentally have to kind of concentrate on more than others. But do you find it? I sometimes get overwhelmed by it.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something that you're familiar with?
Absolutely. I feel like, you know, as a, again, quote unquote, activist, I'm supposed to say that, you know, I have some measures for making sure that I don't get too overwhelmed. But the secret is that I find it very hard to stop. And in the past, it's actually gotten quite bad. You know, I burnt out really badly once or twice, which was a very good lesson for me also, in that if you're doing everything all the time, eventually you're going to hit a wall unless you're some sort of superhuman. And I've met one or two of them. You're going to hit a wall that's going to make you completely useless in those movements, in those courses, and for the people that you care about. So, I mean, I think it's probably a boring answer, but, like, A, you need to rest. And B, we do this work collectively so that individuals can rest when they need to. You know, we're talking about, like, Palestine. I mean, for me, that's something that I feel a deep moral and political attachment to, is, you know, the right of people to exist on their land without being militarily occupied and having bombs fall on them. For the Palestinian whānau in Dunedin, it's just the entire existence of them and their family. They can't turn off and rest, you know. I'm sure they have their own ways of coping, but, you know, they're never going to not wake up and look at the phone and see what the news is. So the fact that we do this work collectively means that if I'm burnt out, I can step away. It also means that a Palestinian whānau, if they just need to be away from, you know, the political side of the movement for 6 months, then hopefully there's a solidarity collective movement that can keep doing that work for them. So the only thing that you can do is sort of, I think, be your own measure of how exhausted and how burnt out you're getting. But, you know, I'm never going to stop caring about, you know, people who are oppressed in one sense or another or exploited, you know, even if it feels overwhelming.
And that's fair enough. What are your – you might not be able to answer this. What are your big causes? What are – you know, if you had to say what your top three – And I don't say that in order to, you know, belittle the remaining 27 or, you know, the remaining 400, you know.
Sure.
Where at this moment in your life, in this moment in time, where is your energy going, and who are you standing in solidarity with the most at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, the first one, which I think is sort of an intersection of all these things again, is, you know, the cause for socialism, because I believe that, you know, the anarchic profit motive is often the drive to a lot of social issues, including war. I won't get into that theoretical deep dive right now. But I guess the other one, if I'm thinking of what am I sort of dedicated to in terms of social movements, Palestine is the big one. And there are a couple of reasons for that. One is just that, you know, often you'll see this, I mean, especially online by people who are just trying to, you know, get a rise out of you, is like, why are you talking about Palestine and not X other bad thing that is happening?
The whole whataboutism thing.
The whataboutism, exactly. It's like, firstly, maybe I do care about that. You don't know. Maybe I am doing work around that and you don't know. And the other thing is that I work full time, like you probably do, this other random person. I only have so many hours in a day. I can't be all things to all people all the time. And this other person knows that, you know, and they're just trying to make a silly argument. For one reason or another, Palestine in around 2019, I think, was something that I just dived into and committed myself to, you know, to understanding the history of and the struggle today. The other reason that I really dedicate myself to that is because I really do think that, you know, Palestine is the cause of the world and needs our attention. It is the intersection of feminist rights. You know, we've seen women giving birth and rubble and not having access to menstrual products and all of that sort of horrible thing. It's, you know, humanitarian, generally speaking, like people are being starved. It's anti-imperialist. The US supports Israel there because it needs sort of a state-sized military base for its interests in the Middle East. These are things that US presidents have said. This isn't just my analysis, you know. There's a famous speech from Biden, I think in the 80s, where he said, if Israel didn't exist, we would have to create one to put out our interest there. This might seem like a strange, spicy one for me to throw in, but it's also about the fight against anti-Semitism, and that I believe that Jewish people, wherever they exist, should be safe, should be full participants in our community. And while a, you know, fully armed genocidal state is pretending that it is the voice of all Jewishness around the world, that's really going to – there are a lot of very politically confused people around there who are going to tie the idea of Jewishness and that faith and that people to a military project, which I think is really scary. So I think for any of us who are also, you know, in the Palestine Solidarity Movement, we also need to educate ourselves and fight actively against anti-Semitism at the same time. So it's all of these things rolled in together. So that's kind of why I felt that it's been so important. And obviously over the last few years, it's flared up in a way that I've not seen in my lifetime. And thankfully there has been a very powerful social movement to match that. So it's not just me trying to make moral arguments to people, you know, it's masses of people collectively going out and saying, like, I see the suffering that is happening. Hopefully we are collectively teaching each other as to why this is happening, and trying to find any avenues to reduce the power of those military powers that are making life terrible for people.
And that's something I've noticed, actually. Like, I don't know if it's because I've just started to look a bit outside my own sort of sphere of caring, is that actually, I don't remember. I've been on the planet 54 years coming up. But I don't remember that kind of social thing happening in my past. Like, you know, like people getting behind a cause. I mean, maybe apartheid in South Africa would be the last kind of time I can recall that kind of happening. But Palestine has been one of those things, hasn't it, of recent years. And that, I think that's a good thing. I don't see a solution to it still. That's the worry for me, is that I'm a solutions person. I like to see an answer and an end game. But I think we can't. I'm encouraged by the fact that people haven't stopped.
Yeah. I'm also a solutions person, which can make social movements very frustrating sometimes, because often You know, I mean, if like I say, we're talking about like an imperialism that's backed by the US. It's like, I don't think me and Richard here are going to stop the largest military power on the world, you know? But also, you know, and we are not, despite the fact that New Zealand is islands, we are not an island. You know, we are connected by a thousand threads to the rest of the world. And so is our government. And, you know, people like to talk about the anti-apartheid movement and, you know, the anti-nuclear movement and all of those things. We as, you know, as a nation, I suppose, didn't make those, draw those excellent lines in the sand, those very moral and good political, you know, lines that we will not cross. We will not support apartheid. We will not support nuclear here. Because we didn't, it didn't happen because the government was very nice and decided that they wanted to do the right thing. It's because there were huge social movements of everyday, ordinary working people, students, whoever, who got together and organized and said, we need to stop this.
And that's where we need to stop this. I told you we're running out of time. You just sit there while I rolled out the show. Thank you, Brandon. Welcome back on the show anytime.
Thank you so much.
Well, that's a wrap for this week. Thank you for tuning in. I've been Richard Knights, and you've all been wonderful. Remember, if you're looking for robust, respectful adult debate about all things local and further afield, and a welcoming online community doesn't take itself too seriously, come and find What's News Dunedin on Facebook and join our fun. On next week's show, we'll be talking to Rinad Tamimi, Between Olive Trees and Cold Seas. Look forward to seeing you next Friday at 12 on ORFM. And if you want to listen to the show again and share it with your friends, you can find the podcast at oar.org.nz or even on Spotify, YouTube, or your favorite podcast provider.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.